The Sunday Baroque podcast is made possible by WSHU and the Friends of Sunday Baroque. You can find out more about the Friends of Sunday Baroque and find out how to become one yourself by visiting our website, sundaybaroque.org, under the Contact tab. Melanie Punter is a professional double bass player, a veteran principal bass with Tallahassee Ballet, Atlanta Baroque Orchestra, and Tallahassee Symphony Orchestra. For four decades, Melanie Punter has also been a member of the Orchestra of St. Luke's and a bassist with Caramore Music Festival in New York. The Manhattan School of Music graduate has also been a hands-on teacher and a member of the faculty of Florida State University College of Music from 1996 until her retirement in 2019. Melanie Punter joins me via Zoom to talk about her life in music. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So first, how are you now and how have you been doing during the pandemic?
Well, when I retired in 2019, I had these magnificent plans of resting. I had some minor surgery I had to get done, finally time to do it. Wanted to travel. So I did none of those. So I did the surgery. I recouped, recuperated, and basically been doing what everyone else is doing, sheltering in place, listening to a lot of music, watching a lot of Netflix.
Yeah.
Staying safe and healthy.
Yeah, that's good. That's good. What are you watching on Netflix?
Anything.
All right.
I've also been watching reruns of old baseball that I recorded during spring season last year and part of the season. I'm a big New York Yankees fan.
I was just going to ask, who is your team? Yeah, you can tell by that accent. You know, you may live in Florida, but that accent doesn't go away. All right. Yankees fan. Okay. All right. So when did you first start playing bass? And was that your first instrument? I mean, you know, playing such a big instrument is a pretty big commitment.
Okay. This is the story and this is the truth. I was absent when they handed out the instruments in junior high school.
Oh, man.
I wanted to play viola because in the church choir, I sang alto. Oh. So I figured that would work out well playing this instrument. But I was absent and the only two instruments that were left were the cello and the bass.
Oh,
now, because I was a large girl, I did not think that I wanted to put the cello between my legs sitting down. And I was very uncomfortable about that idea. And so I also thought that playing the bass, I wouldn't have to take it home.
Oh.
I was wrong. The teacher, wonderful, wonderful man, Ira Goldberg, talked to my mother, who was a teacher, and they collaborated and worked out. He saw something in me and they worked out that how I would get my instrument home and I would have practice, etc.
Wow, that is an amazing story. And I mean, boy, was Mr. Goldberg right, huh?
Yes, he was. He really was.
That's extraordinary. So you were what, like 11, 12 years old, something like that?
I was 12, 13, yeah.
Okay. And that was the first instrument you played? You hadn't done piano or?
Piano, yes. Okay. I did have piano.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. So you knew music. You knew you had an affinity for music already by the time you made this big commitment to this big instrument.
Yes. Yes.
So how and when did you realize that this was more than just a fun thing to do in school, but really your calling in life? At what point did that happen for you?
When I was in ninth grade, it was suggested that I try out for the High School of Music and Art and Performing Arts High School, which now are the Fiorello High School of Music and the Arts. Mm-hmm. Also, that if I chose that instrument, that there weren't many women playing. That was presented to me that way. and that I would have a better opportunity. So I just took that at face value at the time.
Yeah.
I didn't give it much thought. It wasn't until I got into high school that I realized that I really liked this.
Yeah.
And I liked the idea of being the foundation of the orchestra. I liked that responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
All the other instruments could sit in that sound.
Yeah.
That's what I loved.
Yeah, yeah. This is really fascinating because, you know, a lot of teenagers would say, oh, man, I don't want to be different. You know what I mean? You know, the idea that you, like, that grabbed you, that was appealing to you to say, like, ooh, there aren't a lot of women who do this. You know, that's something, a challenge you were willing and eager to take on. That's very telling.
Well, it was also presented that I would have a better opportunity.
Sure. Sure.
So I took it more that way
mm-hmm.
also.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I'm glad you mentioned the High School of Music and Art in New York. What was that experience like for you?
Oh, that was great. I remember high school like it was yesterday. I don't remember my college life.
Wow.
I don't remember what happened yesterday, but my high school was wonderful. It was the time of the 60s. So much was going on. Protests, you know, voices being heard, young people speaking out. It was great. And I had wonderful teachers who, I was very fortunate, they saw something in me and encouraged me and told me I should take private lessons. Mm-hmm. I should try out for different orchestras, you know, New York City at all city high school orchestra,
mm-hmm.
Queensboro orchestra, because I lived in Queens.
Mm-hmm.
I took advantage of those. So my Saturdays were very busy.
Yeah, not to mention all the other days too, probably.
Yes.
So that's awesome, really. And I think it has to have, having those kinds of teachers that made such a deep impression on you in those formative years and people who were real mentors and, you know, helped steer you in this career when you were so young. I'm sure that has affected the teacher and mentor that you are. Do you have any kind of, I don't know, recollections of maybe something that you got from one of your teachers and mentors that you've internalized that you like to pass on to your students?
Well, when I was a senior in high school, I auditioned for the New York String Orchestra, and that was with Alexander Schneider, and he was alive at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And he always told us to breathe, to breathe. And that is something that I tell my students, and I've come up with the acronym BRF, B-R-F, breathe so that you can focus. Wait a minute. Breathe so you can relax, so you can focus. BRF. Roof.
Wow. Yeah. And what happens
when kids take their juries or they come to audition, they're nervous. You know, they want to put their best foot forward. And so I'll say, roof. And then inevitably they smile and that automatically relaxes them. So that is definitely something I took away from my early years.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And you've worked with a number of other quite acclaimed conductors, Andre Previn, Charles McCarris, Donald Ronicles, Roger Norrington, Pablo Eras Casado, and lots of others, a list too long to name. So for people who don't know what it's like to play in an orchestra, and then particularly when you play with different conductors, how do they vary from one to the next? What is it like? What does the conductor bring to that experience that might vary from one to the next? And what are some of your particular recollections?
Well, they bring their ideas. And working with the Orchestra of St. Luke's, and for that length of time, we have developed like a symbiosis. We know what we're doing, who to look at, you know, how to breathe, etc. And so a lot of the conductors, I remember Andre Previn, you know, he just loved to be there because he would move his hand and we would do it.
Mm-hmm.
So that each one of them had a special quality Roger is very joyful and playful. And a lot of times he would just sit and let us play. And it was great. He would sit right in the middle of the orchestra. We had to really just lock into each other. Mm-hmm. And his joy, you know, brought a lot to working. And I'm using that word loosely because it didn't feel like work.
Yeah.
So each conductor brought their own personality. And then I'd like to think we helped bring it out.
Yeah. So, that's great. So tell me about your instruments.
Okay. I have three. And the first one is a plywood instrument, my very first instrument. And I went to Spoleto Festival in 1970. It was my first time overseas. And it was great. And I was going from Spoleto, traveling down to this little village called Minori on the Amalfi Coast, where there was another little festival. So I had to get my instrument from Rome. All right, so they got us to Rome, to this little village south of Amalfi. Well, I got on the train. The conductor went, the train conductor goes, "Oh, no, you know, he's moving his hands. I know you can't." And I said, "It's Italian." And he says, "His name is," and I quickly came up with the name Antonello. So he laughed, and we figured out how to get the bass on the train. And that's my first instrument, Antonello. Then in 1977, I got Elsa.
Oh.
My instrument, Elsa, it's a German instrument. It's dated at the late 1800s. And she has a lion's head scroll.
Ooh.
I named her Elsa after the lioness in Born Free.
Oh.
She's big, and she has a nice, warm, maternal sound. And so that's Elsa. And then the Baroque instrument is Ella, named after that famous Baroque singer, Ella Fitzgerald. it's smaller, late 1700s. And she's special also.
How is
so
she special?
So those are my three instruments.
Tell me more about Ella. What makes her special?
The thing about Ella that I like is that she's small.
Okay.
And so it's a little bit more easy to maneuver. And as I'm getting older, that helps. But she has a nice warm sound. She is an Italian instrument, and she always responds when I when I need it. I've played her, you know, I've tuned her up to play for the modern orchestras.
Oh.
She doesn't bring the same color that Elsa does for the big orchestras. So I really do like keeping her in more from a Baroque style. And so I have her set up that way now.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So this is an interesting question, because, and it's something that I ask of all musicians that I speak with who play, you know, a Baroque version of their instrument. Because, you know, I, for example, play modern flute, and I have had the opportunity to try good quality Baroque flutes, and it is a different animal. I'm telling you, it's a very, very different technique, very different embouchure, very different airstream, for example. So I know that it's got to be very, very different to play the Baroque version of your instrument. And I wonder how you were first introduced to that, and how did that speak to you as something that was, you know, something you wanted to pursue?
Wow, that's an interesting question. When I was in high school, there was a cellist that I became a good friend of. We became good friends. And she, Christine Gummery, and she encouraged me. She was playing Baroque instruments. She encouraged me to do this. And what I took from that was how to play light. Now, my instrument was not set up as a Baroque instrument at the time. It was just about how to blend with a cellist. And like I talked about, having the sound sit in the bass, you know, the 16 foot. And so I learned a lot from her and different cellists that I've come across on how to maneuver that sound. I've not taken any particular lessons on that. John Shu, who was wonderful, wonderful conductor and a dear, dear man, really helped me understand how to blend, especially when it was a bassoon, the cello and the bass, and how what my role was just to put the be the foundation. So that's basically how I approach my early music playing.
So do you play a lot of chamber music? Or because, you know, again, you don't necessarily, one doesn't necessarily think of the bass as a chamber music instrument so much. But then when you think about the Baroque version of it, it's much more of a, I don't know, known quantity, or a little bit, it seems like it's a little bit more common.
Well, the orchestras that I've played in, Baroque ensembles, are smaller, of course. And so I'm usually the only one. So I play with the Atlanta Baroque Orchestra, and I played with John Shue's Apollo Ensemble. And here in town in Tallahassee, we have a wonderful group called the Bach, Tallahassee Bach Parlay. And so this is, and you know, where I get to do my thing here, which is great, because there is life outside of New York City. And it took me a while to accept that, and I'm so glad I did.
Yeah, for sure. So do you have favorite composers? And it doesn't have to be Baroque, but, you know, just in general, are there favorite composers both for listening, because you said you've been listening to a lot of music during COVID, but also, you know, favorite composers for playing?
Well, my favorite composer, is Brahms.
Really?
Because Brahms wrote amazing bass lines. And I used to always say to my students, either he loved his father or he hated his father, because the bass lines are hard. But they're separate from the cello line.
Right.
And it you get a sense of what your purpose is in the orchestra as a string player, as the lowest of the string instruments. So I've always, that developed from high school, that I just, like, my eyes opened and, oh, Brahms, just fabulous. Yeah.
And what about also for listening? Brahms as well?
Yeah, Brahms. Oh, and the Bach, you know, I mean, it's Brahms, and then for playing, Brahms and then Bach, of course, you know, Telemann. But I love listening to the Baroque music, especially during this COVID time.
Yeah.
You know, I would get on YouTube and do a lot of listening, and then I would pull out the bass maybe and see if I could play with someone, you know, get the music. And then I'd get frustrated because I want to play with live people, not on television.
I know.
That works.
Are there a couple of favorites you want to recommend? Because, you know, obviously everybody's in the same boat, and you know, people who listen to Sunday Baroque are a little bit, you know, partial to Baroque music. Are there any interesting things you've stumbled on YouTube that you want to tell us about?
Well, the one that I just totally fell in love with, and I listened to it a lot, was the Handel Haydn performance of the Messiah this past year.
It's just
amazing. Reggie Mobley, you know, I mean, it's just, and he went to Florida State, so he's one of ours.
Yeah.
But that's something that I go to just either when I'm feeling down or when I'm feeling really good. It was just so well done in this time, you know, because of what was going on, that music was still being made. That really touched me.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's Messiah. It's that's a pretty good bullseye piece for this time, isn't it? So you are a woman in symphony orchestras, which have not traditionally been very welcoming to women in general. And you are a woman in a seriously male-dominated bass section of the orchestra, as we already talked about. You knew what you were getting into on that, though. And you are a Black woman in the world of classical music. And I'm hoping that you'd be willing to talk a little bit about what it was like to break through those doors and what it's been like to be there all these years. Maybe what you've seen and experienced. Maybe, I hope, changes in the way things are done. Maybe what you hope to see in the future.
Well, it always surprised me that there weren't more people of color, women, playing in any of these orchestras. And for me, being playing with St. Luke's for so many years, I was the only one. And I didn't really understand that. You know, I was young. And so it's a family situation. We grew up, I'm godmother to several kids. And we were growing up together. The way I feel about it now is that it's not acceptable. I didn't have the voice at the time because I was trying to survive in that freelance world where you, even though you're playing with, you know, with your orchestra and your friends, you had to be on top of everything. I'll admit it was kind of selfish. I was taking care of myself. And as time went on, there are more women playing the bass, which is fabulous, which is just like, yes, this is the way it should be. But it was very lonely. And I knew many, many people of color who were very fine players, but just didn't have that, weren't given the opportunity. I don't know why I was given the opportunity. I am blessed and I'm very much aware of that, but we have to do better.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you have any suggestions, any ideas, even just, I don't know, ruminations on how can we open those doors? How can we do better? And how can we move classical music forward in a more inclusive and equitable way?
Well, as a educator, I, you know, now I'm no longer in, you know, in the New York City area, but, you know, even where I was, you know, people come from all over to grow, you know, get their education. And so when they go to New York, and I can only speak of that, we have to be able to be willing to go into the schools and listen and hear recommendations from other players, from other people. Mm-hmm. You know, freelancing, and especially now, is very difficult because the business is shrinking. So I understand you're hanging on for dear life. Like I say, I am blessed and I am very fortunate to have been able to get a job that had this job security that I had for those years in teaching and the benefits that were offered me and the ability to continue to travel. You know, Florida State encouraged their professors to perform. Mm-hmm. So I went to Atlanta, you know, and I came back and made up my lessons. I take the auto train, you know, to get outside of DC and then drive to New York to play with St. Luke's. So it's important for educators, teachers, our performers to be willing to hear who's out there, to see. It's about opening your eyes. You know, we live a lot of times in like a tunnel vision. Mm-hmm. That's my suggestion. There are so many of us who teach, who are out there, who come across these wonderful, wonderful players that need a chance. Mm-hmm. And they usually are women and women of color.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And as I, you know, when I have conversations like this with other people, I remind fellow music lovers, fellow musicians, or whatever, that, you know, by not doing this, we're depriving ourselves of a lot of genius and talent.
Yes.
And so there's a real cost to everyone involved, because there's talent that's not being cultivated and it's not being appreciated and heard.
Yes. When back in the late 70s, I was in an orchestra called the Symphony of the New World. And it was interracial group. And it was deliberate. The conductor at the time, Benjamin Steinberg, I remember I called and I wanted to audition. And he said, yes, come. And when I showed up, he said, oh, I didn't know you were Black. And so at the time, I didn't know how to respond to that.
Wow.
But that's the what we come across, especially being classical musicians. I'm not supposed to play this music. I'm not supposed to love Brahms.
Yeah.
You mean I can't rock to Bach, which I do all the time? I'm dancing constantly when I'm playing. How can you not?
Yeah.
You know? So what does that mean?
Yeah.
That's the, you know, we need to, education.
Mm-hmm.
Constantly educate. Yes, I'm Black. I was Black when I called you. You know, I don't know what I was supposed to say, sir, missa, what?
Yeah.
You know, so that is still very disturbing to me.
Yeah. Understandably. So what do we music lovers need to do that's more than just talk about this? What can I do? What can people listening to this, what can we do? You know, you're a performer and you have your perspective, you're doing your part, but what can we do to try to make some meaningful change? Do you have suggestions?
Well, when you're sitting in an orchestra, in an audience,
mm-hmm.
and you're looking up on stage and you don't see what the world is, looks like, then you need to question. They ask for surveys, they ask for comments, you write a letter. This world is made up of many different races and genders, and that should be reflected on the stage,
mm-hmm.
no matter what stage it is.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that listeners and audiences need to question that. You know, I understand that sometimes it's difficult because as a Black person, I get on stage and I look in the audience and see who's out there, you know,
yeah.
And I, you know, it's like, well, where are they, you know? And I mean, I can tell my family, but, you know, some of them live in Arizona, you know, I have a great niece lives in Australia. What are they going to do?
Right.
You know,
right,
so
right.
It's up to us as listeners and concert goers to question, you know, I love the music. How come it's not more diverse? It's not the first thing that trips off your tongue. It may be now, you know, after what's been happening in the past year, but this is years. We marched for this,
yeah.
You know, in the late 60s. This should be second nature. You know, America is made up of many, many different types of people, because those are the people that came over to make a better life for themselves.
Right.
African Americans, we didn't. We were brought here. And so we're still struggling. We shouldn't have to struggle.
Yeah.
I'm getting on my soapbox, but that's
go for it.
That's the sadness of it all.
Yeah.
And as a woman of a certain age, it's really sad,
yeah.
at this point. So I'm still trying to, you know, even though I'm no longer in that education institution, I'm still looking for young people of color, you know, audition, do it, work hard. Yes, I was told as a Black woman, when I was auditioning, I had to be better than. And even if it was in the screen, you couldn't be equal to, you had to be better than, you know, that's a lot. And, you know, I'm a little exhausted by that, but it's still happening and we still have to do it.
Yeah. 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 I'd love to bring this around and just kind of see if you have any, I don't know, looking back on this amazing career with all these different people you've played with and orchestras you've played with, do you have any, I don't know, any particularly fun recollections or maybe a fun or interesting anecdote that you'd like to share from your career? Chance encounter, maybe?
Oh, well, with the Orchestra of St. Luke's, Paul McCartney performed with us. He did his album Standing Stone, mm-hmm. and he came to New York and he rehearsed with us. And it was so funny because here were these women of a certain age, just like giddy. We were so excited. And he was wonderful. He was relaxed and approachable, and he was signing albums. You know, it was great. And after that performance, we were sitting on stage, and he came off stage, and he walked past the bass section, and he kissed me on my cheek. Yes,
and we're the all reaction, a buzz here.
Yes, that was the reaction. You could hear that collective. You
know? Wow!
But the thing that was really funny were the stagehands, who are wonderful at Carnegie Hall, who were saying amongst themselves, now who's going to catch her or the instrument? Because their quiet fainted. So, but I didn't faint, but it was great.
Wow.
And that is something, and I have a picture. Someone captured a picture of that. And it just brings just great smiles to my face. And because of that relationship that he had with the Orchestra of St. Luke's, there are players who have performed with him from the orchestra. And on that night, when I was leaving the stage door, you would think it was a Beatles concert. And as I was leaving the backstage of Carnegie Hall, they opened the door, everybody going, oh, it wasn't you. But then I said, he kissed me, and I got a big cheer.
Oh, so, wow.
That is a memory like I will never forget.
That is fabulous. That is just fabulous. Well, I have been speaking with professional double bass player Melanie Punter, veteran of many, many orchestras, and a native New Yorker who is now in sunny, warm Florida. Thank you so much. What a pleasure to have this conversation with you. Thank you.
Thank you so much for asking me. This was a lot of fun. Thank you.